Well, oftentimes as I'm reading through the Bible, I'll come across a passage or a section of scripture, and I'll think, what really is the point here? And it's not to say that I don't understand the scriptures that I'm reading. A lot of the time I do. I mean, I can comprehend what they are saying, but rather sometimes I feel like there's more to the story than just the words that might be communicating there at face value. And in those instances, I'm sure you've done the same when you've come across those, you try to realize and recognize what is the underlying principle that God is trying to teach us. We are so limited in our understanding of all the amazing thoughts and ideas of God that he often has to break them down into very digestible chunks. And that is especially true with spiritual concepts and spiritual principles. God knows that if we are to grow in our understanding of any of those things, then we need to internalize them through our own life experiences. In other words, we have to connect with them in some way. I think that is a core reason why God gives us so many physical constructs, physical examples, physical experiences. It involves things that we can touch and feel and experience. And that way we can grow to understand through those the things that we cannot. A classic example of this is clean and unclean meats. That is very much a physical construct. It involves what we put into our mouths, after all. But as we dive into that physical construct, we start to understand the spiritual principle that is behind it. It's not, for example, that some unclean foods are bad or something like that, or that those animals are defective in some way. We understand that all of God's creation is good. But by understanding how God has carved off a section of the food chain and separated them for a purpose, well, then we can directly tie that into a spiritual principle about how he does the same thing with his called out people. And then every time we go grocery shopping or we prepare a meal or we pick something off the menu, that physical law reinforces a spiritual principle that might otherwise be a little bit more difficult to wrap our minds around. And as a result, there are so many physical laws and rules and regulations that are the same way. Now, they do have a practical application, that much is for sure, but most importantly, they are trying to drive at a spiritual principle. As we well know, the physical will go away. The spiritual, of course, is for all eternity. So as a result, it is easier to understand, for example, a unique, unified relationship with God in which we fully join ourselves to him, this huge spiritual topic, if we have a physical construct that we can look to, a marriage, two people becoming as one. In that physical way, we can connect the dots to a spiritual principle in a more relatable way. So when I come across some sections of the Bible, especially those that are heavy with physical things, I have a tendency to pull back and say, well, what really is the point here? How is this going to connect to a principle that will be timeless for all eternity? And one of those sections of scripture can be found right off the bat in Genesis chapter 1 and 2. I know what you might be thinking. You might be thinking, Mike, well, you didn't get too far into the book before he started having questions. And that's true, but these chapters of the Bible have been hotly debated for as long as they've been written down. But there is something in these verses, though, and in the creation account more generally, that always made me pause and consider what was beyond the surface. So let's jump into it, shall we? Let's go back to Genesis chapter 1. We're going to pick it up in verse 2, Genesis chapter 1, starting verse 2. It says, the earth was without form and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. And then God said, let there be light. And there was light. And God saw the light, that it was good. And God divided the light from the darkness. So here we have the start of God working on organizing the world. We can see at a high level that God is establishing order from the chaos and assigning the roles and the functions to the various elements of that creation. Further on, we read that God not only divides the light, but the waters, and defines the functions that they are to serve. And this continues on throughout chapter 1. Each day, God is creating and working on specific elements. On the fifth day, verse 20, we see sea creatures, flying creatures. On the sixth day, starting in verse 24, we have land animals, and our most favorite of all the land animals, human beings. This is a lot of work, a culmination of planning and organizing that stretched back, well, I mean, who knows how long. Genesis 1:31 now. Then God saw everything that he had made, and indeed it was very good. So the evening and the morning were the sixth day. Now there is a lot happening in the description of those 6 days, that's for sure. But here, this is where it gets most interesting, at least for the purpose of the message today, and that's in chapter 2, now verse 1. Genesis chapter 2, verse 1. It says, "Thus the heavens and the earth and all the hosts of them were finished." Verse 2. "And on the seventh day, God ended his work which he had done, and he rested." And he rested on the seventh day from all his work which he had done. And then God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, because in it he rested from all his work which God had created and made. Now, for sure, we understand that one of the points behind these scriptures is to give us an example and a template of the seventh day Sabbath. But even in that point, there's several questions. Like, why did God give us that example? He doesn't give us an example of some of the other constructs. I mean, he never comes down and slaughters an ox so that he can show the difference between clean and unclean meats to Adam and Eve. And what does it even mean that God rested? How does a deity rest? How can someone that does not tire rest? And then notice this back in Isaiah chapter 40, if you want to head there. We'll go verses 28 through 31, Isaiah 40, verses 28 through 31. Isaiah 40, verse 28, "Have you not known? Have you not heard? The everlasting God, the Lord, the creator of the ends of the earth, neither faints nor is weary. His understanding is unsearchable." Then notice all these things that he does constantly. Verse 29, "He gives power to the weak, and to those who have no might, he increases strength." Just some of his works. Verse 30, "Even the youth shall faint and be weary, and the young men shall utterly fall. But those who wait on the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint." So those are just a few of the actions that God is performing continually and constantly. So did God not do these kind of things so that he could rest? Did he not do those type of supporting functions so that he could abstain from his work? In other words, when thinking about God resting, what really is the point? And can we draw out some principles in this scripture that go beyond the physical? Is it just that human beings aren't supposed to clock into work on Saturdays? That they can sleep in a little bit longer? That they make sure that they don't get their heart rate up too much throughout the day? Is that the point? Or is there something about this concept of rest that is woven throughout the Bible and that can be applied in our spiritual lives as well? A principle that will far outlast anything physical. Well, before we jump in too deep, I first want to get our bearings on the word translated rest in our English Bible. It's an extremely common word used throughout the Bible. Just the word that is translated rest is used in hundreds of scriptures. And that's not counting the Greek and the Hebrew words translated differently or the many variations. The word rest, just that word, is the 272nd most commonly used word in the Bible, which is a crazy stat that we will all instantly forget, I'm sure. And there are plenty of times in the Bible where that word means exactly what you think it means. Like to let your oxen rest. When it says that, that means to not farm with it, to let it wander around, eating the grass, going in the shade, doing whatever oxen like to do. And there are other passages where someone is physically tired and then they rest. So those are obvious applications of that word. It's also a euphemism of someone dying. For example, the Bible records that this king or that king, when they died, they rested with their fathers. So I guess that's kind of the ultimate when thinking about decreasing your physical activity. That's zero physical activity in that case. But the rest concept, though, it kind of continues to expand outward and in some interesting ways. Let's notice Leviticus chapter 25. Leviticus chapter 25. Leviticus chapter 25, we'll pick it up in verse 3. Leviticus chapter 25, verse 3. It says, 6 years you shall sow your field, and 6 years you shall prune your vineyard and gather its fruit. In other words, you're using it as designed, right? We would say that you are working the field. Verse 4. But in the seventh year there shall be a Sabbath of solemn rest for the land, a Sabbath to the Lord. You shall neither sow your field nor prune your vineyard. What grows of its own accord of your harvest you shall not reap, nor gather the grapes of your untended vine, for it is a year of rest for the land. Now we have this concept of rest now that's expanded even to the land. The land itself was to have rest. And this is so important that in the following chapter, one of the key warnings that God gave his nation is to say, you know, if you turn your back on me, if you decide to go your own way, contrary to my ways, then in Leviticus chapter 26, verses 27 and 28, then God is going to go contrary to you. And God is going to bring in all sorts of disasters and consequences. And guess what that even includes? Leviticus 26, now verse 32. Leviticus 26, 32. And I will bring the land to desolation, and your enemies who dwell in it shall be astonished at it. And I will scatter you among the nations and draw out a sword after you. Your land shall be desolate and your cities waste. Verse 34. Then the land shall enjoy its Sabbaths. As long as it lies desolate and you are in your enemy's land, then the land shall rest and enjoy its Sabbaths. The land must have rest. And if you turn away from me, God says he's going to ensure that this will happen, whether they're there to experience it or not. So we have all of these examples of rest in various form. Maybe there's a unifying thread. But the definition of what we think of when we hear that term rest, at least in my mind, starts to get a little bit stretched. Because once the Israelites are taken out of Egypt as slaves and a course is plotted for them to the promised land, God promises that once they arrive, they will enter and experience rest. Now, that would have been a fantastic promise to those people, especially for those that were in slavery, in harsh physical bondage, with never-ending physical labor. The thought of rest, even at a physical level, should have been very tantalizing to them. But is that the reality of what happened? Now, we know the story of the Israelites and how they rebelled and how the vast majority of those original people that left Egypt did not enter the promised land, not even Moses there. But let's fantasize just for a second and let's pretend that they didn't rebel. Let's pretend that they got their act together. They really got on board. They really rallied instead and they held it together. They stopped their bickering ways and they get on board with what God was doing. And now, when they get to the Jordan River, and they're about ready to cross over into this long-awaited promised land, then do they finally get physical rest? Well, no. I mean, not really. Not if you're thinking just about physical rest. If you're thinking about just decreasing your physical activity, that's not what they experienced. Now, when they cross over, their physical activity really starts to ramp up. Really? They have to go to war. They have to tear down strongholds. They have to tear down fortresses. They have to fight armies. And even once that's done, they have to then build up their houses. They have to plant their farms. None of that sounds all that restful to me. Maybe, you know, after a generation or two, once their enemies are vanquished and the laundry list of tasks just for living is completed, well, then maybe the word rest might have been fitting. Let's jump forward in time and pick up the thread in Joshua. Joshua chapter 21. Joshua chapter 21, we're going to go to verse 43 and 44. There are many companion scriptures that we could use, but I picked the one now that's towards the end of Joshua's life, because now it's years and years after they entered the promised land. So now, do they have this rest? Joshua 21, verse 43. So the Lord gave to Israel all the land of which he had sworn to give their fathers, and they took possession of it and dwelt in it. Verse 44. The Lord gave them rest all around, according to all that he had sworn to their fathers. And not a man of all their enemies stood against them. The Lord delivered all their enemies into their hand. Well, now, I guess I don't get it. Is that the rest that God was talking about? Not rest from physical activities, but rest from war? Because if so, that certainly doesn't last very long, does it? Remember, the Israelites never really pushed the nations fully out, and they battled with them over and over again. So I guess to me, this is where the concept of rest starts to unravel just a bit. We have all these themes of what rest is, but it's not always obvious, at least in the question that I posed at the beginning, what really is the point? All of these themes may fit some scenarios, like physical rest or decreased activity or peace from external enemies. They fit some of the scenarios, but the whole puzzle doesn't seem like the pieces are all that cohesively linked together. Let's go to Hebrews chapter 3 now. Hebrews chapter 3. I think here is where we will start to form some connection points, and heading back to Hebrews chapter 3 and 4. And in these chapters, the writer begins to pull together the underlying spiritual principle behind all of these physical examples, and then links it back to our own spiritual journey. Because there is something connected in how God rested on the seventh day back in Genesis, to the Israelites in the promised land, to the four type of rest in the millennium, all the way to the rest that is ultimately promised for all eternity in the kingdom. But what is that connection? What can we learn from that connection? And then finally, how will that change how we approach commanded rest days? Well, again, we're back in Hebrews chapter 3. Let's pick it up in verse 7 now. Hebrews chapter 3, verse 7 says, "Therefore, as the Holy Spirit says, today, if you will hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as in the rebellion in the day of trial in the wilderness." We just read that, "where your fathers tested me, tried me, and saw my works 40 years. Therefore, I was angry with that generation and said, they always go astray in their heart, and they have not known my ways." Verse 11, "so I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest." Let's drop down to verse 17 now. Still in Hebrews 3, now verse 17. "Now with whom was he angry 40 years? Was it not with those who sinned, whose corpses fell in the wilderness? And to whom did he swear that they would not enter his rest, but to those who did not obey?" Then notice here this next part. This is where all the threads begin to intertwine together. Verse 19. "So we see that they could not enter in because of unbelief." Now they, the Israelites, that God rescued from slavery in Egypt. They could not enter the promised land and therefore experience this promised rest because of why? Because of unbelief. Well, you might be thinking, why would that stop them? I mean, God often had to drag them by their collars to get them to where they needed to be, often in spite of themselves, over and over again. From the plagues to the parting of the Red Sea, all the way to the very door of the Promised Land, God did many signs and wonders to show them that He was God. And time again, they didn't really get it. So why now? Why now was that the issue? Did they run out of chances? Was this kind of finally the breaking point? Why would unbelief prevent them from entering into this rest? Again, what is the point being made here? Now, if it was just physical rest exclusively or protection from external enemies alone, that would have been simple. In fact, God was already doing that in their journey in many ways. But for this type of promised rest, it was something different. There was a physical component, that's for sure. Resting from external enemies as long as they followed God. And that for sure was a key part. But most importantly, it was spiritual in nature as it deals with the relationship that God wanted to have with them. And that spiritual rest was to be able to enter into a relationship with God as God made His resting place with them. Does that sound familiar? Because it should. Rest as a place and a condition where a relationship can grow is very much a unifying theme. It happened back in Genesis on the seventh day. It happened in part with Israelite in the tabernacle, with the nation in the temple, and with the Word becoming flesh and dwelling among men. Hold your place here because we're going to come back, but let's flip back to Ephesians chapter 2. Hold your place in Hebrews, but we're going to go to Ephesians 2. Picking up in verse 19, Ephesians 2, verse 19, says, "Now therefore you are no longer strangers and foreigners, but fellow citizens with the saints and members of the household of God, having been built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets, Jesus Christ Himself being the chief cornerstone, in whom the whole building, being joined together, grows into a holy temple in the Lord, in whom you also are being built together for a dwelling place of God in the Spirit." Now, it will happen in the millennium. And as we well know, since Jesus Christ went to prepare a place for us, it will happen again in God's kingdom forever. But if you don't have belief in God, you can never have that relationship. You can't join together in that rest because you don't want it. You're going to spend your time and your energy and effort in the wrong activities and neglect that spiritual relationship. If we think back about it, what was God trying to do with those Israelites? Now, we do know that God is a wonderful God and He blesses us far beyond what we deserve. I know He blesses me far beyond what I deserve, and He gives good gifts to His people. And of course, we know that by taking them to the promised land, He was fulfilling a promise given to Abraham to give this land to his descendants. There's no doubt about that. But He wasn't just giving the promised land as a little party favor and then ducking and walking out. The promised land was a blessing. It was a destination, but it wasn't the point that God was trying to do. That point was a relationship. And frankly, gaining the promised land wasn't designed to be the end of the story, but rather in many, many ways, it was the start of a whole new story. And once they entered the land, the nation could then be linked together with God in the most remarkable way, a special treasure, modeling a relationship with the Creator in a way that had never been conceived of before. The original Israelites that left Egypt, they never got it, or they never wanted it, or they never really believed in that relationship. The Israelites that came after them had pockets here and there, as we know, that are a little bit better, but never consistently and constantly. It's in all of that context we get to Hebrews chapter 4. Let's flip back there. Still in Hebrews, but now in chapter 4. It's with all of that context in mind, we pick it up in verse 1. Hebrews 4, now verse 1. Therefore, since a promise remains of entering his rest, let us fear lest any of you seem to have come short of it. So this is now shifting ahead towards the future. This is talking about our relationship now. Verse 2. For indeed the gospel was preached to us as well as to them, but the word which they heard did not profit them, not being mixed with faith in those that heard it. They didn't believe. They didn't want it. Verse 3. For we who have believed do enter that rest. As he has said, so I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest, although the works were finished from the foundation of the world. For he has spoken in a certain place of the seventh day in this way, and God rested on the seventh day from all his works. And again, in this place, they shall not enter my rest. Certainly, they did not enter that full spiritual rest that involved a committed relationship with the creator of the universe. And maybe they and others did receive some of the physical blessings of rest. They did have periods of peace, that's for sure. They did have physical rest on the Sabbath, that's for sure. But as we well know, the physical was there to help illustrate the spiritual. The physical itself was not the end goal. Now verse 8. Hebrews 4 verse 8 now. For if Joshua had given them rest, he couldn't. For if Joshua had given them rest, then he would not afterward have spoken of another day. Now Joshua could have only enforced physical rest. That spiritual rest from a relationship with God was something different entirely. Now, I want to pause just for a moment and come at this from a different perspective. I want to use an analogy, and I wish I was smart enough to say I came up with this analogy all by myself, but I didn't. It came from a gentleman by the name of John Walton. If you've never heard that name before, he is one of the prominent old scholars living today. If you have a cultural study Bible, especially one that has the Old Testament cultural part in it, more often than not, he's probably in there somewhere, either as the primary or one of the contributing authors. And he's especially skilled at making connections between the written text of the Bible and the cultural understanding of what the audience of each of those books were written to. Now, it goes without saying that the Bible and its principles are timeless. We know that. But for sure, each one of them was written in a different language to a specific audience and for a specific purpose. And the further we are removed from that culture, then some of the connection points that the writer makes in the Bible can sometimes be more difficult to understand. Imagine some poor archaeologist 300 years in the future came across some of my text messages, and I said, well, I don't want to go into work today, but I'm just going to bite the bullet. Well, they might think, well, isn't he a programmer? It doesn't sound all that dangerous. Why would he bite a bullet? That doesn't make any sense. Of course, we understand that cultural idiom, so it makes sense to us. And John Walton, in his book, The Lost World of Adam and Eve, he makes a case that in the Genesis account, which we often call the creation account, it likely hit the audience in a slightly different way. Modern people often look at Genesis and try to make claims of scientific authenticity or try to discredit the Bible from some scientific perspective. And Walton argues that no one originally was thinking about that account as the literal material construction of matter. As in, they weren't thinking like God took two hydrogen atoms and one oxygen and he combined them to make water. The original audience wasn't thinking anything like that. Instead, one of the bigger perspectives is how God ordered the known universe, how he divided the chaos into a functioning, ordered system. And God then, through those 6 days, organized and set into motion the proper place and function of that creation. Whereas the material origin, like the physical makeup, is secondary to the purpose of it. And Walton uses the analogy of a house. When you first move into a house, the physical components are likely already there. You have walls, you have a roof, hopefully you have plumbing and electricity, but it doesn't become a home until you organize it. You set your furniture in it, and then you begin to use it as it's designed. A place with walls and a floor doesn't become a dining room until you put in a table and you start having meals there. It doesn't become a living room until the family gathers there. Maybe plays games, maybe sits around a fireplace. It becomes that specific room when you designate it and assign it purpose, and then you begin to use it as such. And if we expand this analogy, when you first purchase a property, you might have a house. It might be filled with boxes, but it's not organized. It's chaotic. But once you get everything where it needs to be and start using it as its design, then it finally becomes a home. You have created a home out of a house when you begin to function it as it was designed. And that's why some people, when they're on vacations, they never really feel like they're at home. Maybe you felt that way. Now, all of the physical things are there. They have rooms and furniture and stuff, and it might be a lovely place. It might be very relaxing, but it doesn't quite feel like your home. It's not set up and organized and functioning in the way that you feel like it is your true resting place, the place where you feel most at home. And Walton again makes the case that in the creation account, God puts everything together so that a relationship can happen. It's not that God is so tired after 6 days that he has to take the seventh day off, but rather the seventh day is the reason for all the other six. It's the culmination of why God did all of that so that he could then have a relationship with his creation. And that happens so many times throughout the Bible. He takes his people out of Egypt and he's ready to plant them in the promised land. In the millennium, there will be peace with everyone under their own vine and fig tree. In all those cases, God is offering to make his dwelling place, his resting place with his people. He puts all of the pieces in place. He will organize. He will divide the chaos and provide order. But it's not so that the Israelites can sleep in. It's not so that they could just rest in a little bit longer. It's so that they didn't have to spin their wheels. It's so that they could break out of the trap of futile pursuits and experience rest in that relationship with God. God gets everything ready, but the people still have to choose. They still have to choose. And that's where these concepts become so interlinked together. The rest is not to save energy. It's to redirect your energy towards something completely different. To shift away from the physical and devote time to the spiritual. To leave the other cares and the other desires and the other priorities and all the work and have rest with God. Verse 9, still in Hebrews 4, verse 9 now. Hebrews 4, now verse 9. It says, there remains, therefore, a rest for the people of God. That's you and me. For he who has entered his rest has himself also ceased from his works as God did from his. If we are seeking to enter that spiritual rest, then we take our time, our energy, our effort, the summation of our work, and we redirect it towards that relationship with God. Just as God, when he put the creation in order and it got it functioning as designed, stopped that work to have a relationship with that creation. Finally, the last verse, verse 11 here in Hebrews 4. Let us therefore be diligent to enter that rest, lest anyone fall according to the same example of disobedience. So what then? Do we believe? Do we desire? Are we committed to that type of relationship? Well, hopefully we see what little this has to do with physical rest and how much more it has to do with the spiritual commitment. And the writer goes on to hammer home this point in Hebrews. We won't continue, but if we were to keep reading in this chapter, we have the Word of God. We have a high priest that understands our struggles. We have all of these tools so that we can go boldly before God. For what purpose? To strive towards that relationship as He makes His dwelling place with us. When we think about what rest means in that context and the reason behind these rest periods, some of the things that Christ had against His Pharisees or against the Pharisees start to hit just a little bit differently. Let's notice an example in Matthew chapter 12. Matthew chapter 12. We might start to see a slightly different side to these scriptures now. Matthew 12, we'll pick it up in verse 1. Matthew 12, verse 1. It says, at that time, Jesus went through the grain fields on the Sabbath, and His disciples were hungry and began to pluck heads of grain and to eat. And when the Pharisees saw it, they said to Him, look, your disciples are doing what is not lawful to do on the Sabbath. Now, this is one example of many that we could pick from. I'm sure we all remember the tension that was there between the Pharisees and Jesus Christ. The Pharisees were very strict, especially about what you could and could not do on the Sabbath. But this would include mostly things like how much you could carry, how far you could go, all sorts of restrictions on, well, physical things, because that was their overriding concern. But as we've talked about, that physical part of rest, while it is important, is not the most central principle behind these commandments. And Jesus Christ repeatedly demonstrates the errancy of this thinking. And He often did that by doing physical activity, by working, so to speak. Drop down to verse 10, still in Matthew 12, now verse 10. It says, and behold, there was a man who had a withered hand. And they asked Him, saying, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath, that they might accuse Him? And He said to them, what man is there among you who has one sheep, and if it falls into the pit on the Sabbath, will not lay hold of it and lift it out? Of how much more value then is a man than a sheep? Therefore, it is lawful to do good on the Sabbath. And then He said to the man, stretch out your hand. And he stretched it out, and it was restored as whole as the other. Verse 14, a verse I never could really get my mind around. Then the Pharisees went out and plotted against Him, how they might destroy Him. That was obviously not the right answer in the minds of the Pharisees. Now, you might think, as I did, why would anyone be against healing? It's not like Christ went into a 15-hour surgery or something like that. Surely they would make an automatic exception to someone that is healing, right? Well, if you're only thinking about rest in terms of limiting your physical activity, then it doesn't really matter what the physical activity is. It's all wrong. And you have to limit it in order to be resting. But that's not exclusively the rest Jesus Christ was talking about. Let's back up one chapter to Matthew 11. This is verse 28, a very familiar verse. Matthew 11, verse 28. It says, come to me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Now, this is not just physical. This is not strictly mental and emotional either, although those are absolutely linked together and are involved. But this is about the spiritual, primarily. Jesus Christ isn't going to gently rock us to sleep. It has nothing to do with that. But He wants to have a connected relationship that satisfies the soul. And when it is ultimately realized, fulfills the reason why God created us in the first place. So what does that mean for us personally? What can we do in our day-to-day lives to move us closer to that goal? Well, the most important thing we can do is have belief. Have belief. That was mentioned in Hebrews earlier as one of the core reasons that the Israelites could never get on the right track. Now, I don't think that meant that they didn't believe that God existed. I don't think that was their problem. But they definitely struggled in believing that God, our God, is the only God, and that God wanted to have a unique relationship with them like no others. And for us, we need to continually call to mind our belief in God, not just that God exists, obviously, but what he has promised for us and that unique relationship he wants to have with us. Let's go to John 14 now and verse 1. John 14, verse 1. John 14, verse 1 says, "Let not your heart be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house are many mansions. And if it were not so, I would have told you. I go to prepare a place for you." This is for me and for you. "And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you to myself, that where I am, there you may be also." We all want to take up residence in that mansion. And we believe that God will fulfill and deliver on those promises to us. And that ultimately we will join together in the family of God. Verse 22, still in John 14, now verse 22. Judas, not Iscariot, said to him, "Lord, how is it that you will manifest yourself to us and not to the world?" Verse 23, and Jesus answered and said to him, "If anyone loves me," and that's us, right? "If anyone loves me, he will keep my word, and my Father will love him. And we will come to him and make our home with him," our resting place. This we believe. This we keep in the forefront of our minds as the vision of the future to come. There's more too. Of course, we're here on the Sabbath, a commanded rest day. And absolutely, we understand that we are to abide by the physical part of this commandment. We don't continue in our professions this day. This isn't the day to go out and chop firewood for 10 hours. And we do certainly limit our physical activities in many ways. But if we just replace it by sleeping in a little bit longer and taking naps throughout the day, well, then it wasn't really a net gain at all. In order for us to really utilize these periods of rest, we have to instead redirect our time into that spiritual relationship. Now, I want to notice these two verses in Isaiah 58. Isaiah 58, this is a famous chapter because it puts clarity on two physical things that we often do and highlights the spiritual rationale behind them. Earlier in the chapter, it's talking about fasting, but I want to pick it up in verse 13 and 14 of Isaiah 58. Isaiah 58, verses 13 and 14, it says, "If you turn away your foot from the Sabbath, from doing your pleasure on my holy day," that's not just your work or your job, "and call the Sabbath a delight, a holy day of the Lord honorable, and shall honor him, not by doing your own ways, nor finding your own pleasure, nor speaking your own words," verse 14, "then you shall delight yourself in the Lord." That is the rest we're talking about. "You shall delight yourself in the Lord, and I will cause you to ride on the high hills of the earth and feed you with the heritage of Jacob your father. The mouth of the Lord has spoken." In other words, when we transform our own activities to focusing on that relationship with God, we are maximizing our resting opportunities. And finally, we can also use the example of Jesus Christ to do good during these periods of rest. Those are very much examples of active rest. Far be it from trying to eliminate all physical activity, we will instead be doing different activity. Now, studying and praying and appreciate his creation, those are all key parts, but also having fellowship with our spiritual family, helping others in need, writing cards and letters of encouragement, visiting others, you name it. There's a whole host of things you can do that will bring joy or ease pain and suffering or to provide comfort during those periods. This rest time is built for that. Well, in conclusion, if we revisit our house analogy against the backdrop of where we started, for 6 days, God organized the house. He set all the pieces in their place. He separated the chaos from the boxes. He organized the rooms by their desired use. And at the end of day 6, the house was now a home. and it was ready to be utilized in the way it was designed and intended. And when day seven came about, it was time to actually use that home as was planned from the beginning, to have a relationship with these human beings, to walk among them. When God rested and was refreshed, he was actively participating in a long-awaited relationship with potential sons and daughters. He created the Sabbath for man so that man can rest in him and focus on that relationship. And when God led his people out of Egypt, took them all the way to the promised land, it was for a purpose. As it says in Leviticus 26, verse 12, it says, I will walk among you and be your God, and you shall be my people. Again, all designed to point to that relationship. And then all the way to the very end, in Revelation chapter 21 and verse 3, the final fulfillment of God's resting place, it says this, Revelation 21, 3, and I heard a loud voice from heaven saying, behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and he will dwell with them, and they shall be his people. And God himself will be with them and will be their God. This relationship, the fulfillment of this rest, will finally then be complete. Well, right now, God has given us blessings. He's given us protections. He's given us a congregation that we can attend, a Bible that we can read, and so much more. God has put all the pieces in place so that we can capitalize on that relationship. So let us make sure that we do capitalize on that relationship. The Sabbath, well, just one example of a period of rest, is a wonderful tool designed to point us in the right direction each and every week. Rest is far from simply decreasing physical activity. The rest that God has in mind redirects and engages our strength, not in the physical, but in the spiritual. And so to actively connect in a relationship that will far outlast anything physical. So brethren, when we think about rest, don't let ourselves drift off to sleep, but rather actively participate to the fullest in that relationship with God.